Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet daily. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the history of silver when we come back. You know, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that scriptural principle of law when they put into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10, these 17 words. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation. And in place of these just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system, and they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country? Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in our Mosaic Law School conducted twice a year here at the law school. And if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order our free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. Remember, it's educational, it's informative, and it's entertaining. And best of all, it's free. You can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. We've been talking about this thing of economics, what's going on in the world of economics here in the last few days. There's a second part of this economics showdown that's coming into play. We've been talking about the privateer and William A.M. Buckler and his forecasts or prognostications for the future. The other side of the mainstream press, I call it the underground press, actually it's the free market press, that's telling us that the president's lying to us. And our Secretary of the Treasury, he's been lying to us. Our banks and financial institutions are and have been and will continue to lie to us. The average Joe Sixpacks, you know, all over America from border to border and coast to coast. And because they've got an agenda that they're fulfilling. And this agenda doesn't have your interest or my interest at heart. It has the interests of government, the interests of big business, big banks, big institutions and multinational corporations. They're being looked after quite well with these federal bailouts. And with our power of attorney, which our politicians have by way of our votes, They're using our power of attorney to make us the co-signers or the surety underwriters for all of the bad debts that have been amassed and accumulated since 1933. That has the portent of a bad end. A bad end. So I mentioned the other day, I said, well, okay, now that we've already gone through $29 trillion and we're now the surety underwriters for all of this massive debt that we can't pay back, and there's going to be a bad outcome that comes from it, what should you and I, just little Joe Sixpacks and Sally Housewives and truck drivers and farmers and housewives and carpenters and plumbers, the guys that are down here in the trenches, the producers, you know, the guys that are actually out here buying, selling, trading, producing, making, creating the wheat, the corn, the beans, the honey, and the oil, the houses, and doing the physical work out here, where do we come in to this game, and how do we protect ourselves from the impending collapse? There's a history of silver. Silver is one of the two precious metals. There are a number of precious metals out there. Uranium is one, and rhodium is two. Palladium, gold, silver. There's some rare metals out there, but two of the rare metals are what we call monetary metals. That's gold and silver. The other metals may be rare and they may be expensive and worth a lot of money, but nobody's ever used uranium to buy, sell, and trade with. Palladium and the various metals that are used in industrial applications that are rare are not the kind of metals that we use for buying, selling, and trading, but two metals are, and they're gold and silver. And the history of these metals is very powerful. And it's something for you and I, the average Joe Sixpack. Now, we've been divorced from gold and silver since 1933 and 1965. Up until the Roosevelt administration in 1933, all of us had access to gold and silver coin. We called that hard money. But on June 5th, 1933, a little-known act was created. And it was House Joint Resolution 192, which was later codified and put into our law, that took gold out of circulation, put it into Fort Knox, and gave it ultimately to the bankers, the same people that were now bailing out. They stole all the gold, ran up all these bills, and now you and I have been selected to be the surety underwriters. Well, they make off with all of the gold and silver. You and I get left with a bunch of worthless paper, and then we get left with the debts. And that's not going to bode well for any of us little guys down here. We're all going to pay dearly for this. So what we need to be thinking about as well, okay, now that all this bad, wicked, terrible, awful stuff's been done to us, what do we do to extricate ourselves from it? It isn't that we're going to prevent it. It's already a done deal. It's already an accomplished fact. The gold in Fort Knox is gone, kissed off. It's past history now. The gold and silver that we used to have, it's gone. We don't have it anymore. Somebody else has got it. The debts that have been run up, we've got those. We signed for them. We're on the hook, like it or lump it. So now it would be instructive for us to go back in history and take a look at gold and silver from the perspective of the creator of the universe. You know, there was a guy by the name of God. Well, that's what we call him. Some people call him Allah or Buddha or Yahweh. You know, there's various names, Jehovah, that we've hung on this creature, this fellow, this guy, this God. But he wrote an affidavit. Now, we call it the Hebrew Scriptures, the Bible sometimes, you know, Holy Scripture. He wrote an affidavit. In the affidavit, there are a number of economic laws. We call these statutes. And one of them, the beginning, the foundation of all economic law, is thou shalt not steal. And then it's supported by a number of statutes, about 15 in all. but one of them says you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. That should be a clue to us as it relates to Federal Reserve notes and mortgages and bills of lading and surety underwriting and mortgages and things like that, you know, stocks and bonds and all of these pieces of paper, 401ks, bank accounts, usury. You know, we should have taken a look at this and said, gee, is this really good for us? We didn't. So as a result of that, I'm not here to tell you what you should have done. I'm just pointing out this is what we've done. There's a history that goes with this. But this God back here years and years ago, you know, he said, this is a bad program. You ought to stay away from that. We didn't. And so we should pay attention then to what the outcome is going to be. And he wrote two main chapters. They're called the penal clause chapters. Penal clause. That's Leviticus chapter 26 and Deuteronomy 28. You ought to write those down. Just read them in your spare time. Nothing to get excited about. You don't need to be concerned about what you're going to do to prevent this, because it's already cast in cement. You're not going to advance it. You're not going to retard it. You're not going to prevent it. You're not going to cause it. This is the way it's going to be. It's kind of like driving your car down the road at 80 miles an hour, and you come up to a 35-mile-an-hour curve, and you say, you know, I think instead of slowing down from 80 to 35, I think I'll speed up to 110. Now, about halfway through the curve, when the forces of gravity and inertia meet, and your car becomes airborne, about that time you would say, you know, looking back on this historically, I wished I'd have slowed down rather than speeded up. But by the time your car is 6 inches off the ground at 110 halfway through the curve, it's too late now. There isn't anything that you can do. It's out of your control. Yeah, there's a lot of things we should have done, but we didn't do it. Now the car is in the air. We don't know how this is going to come out over the next 30 to 45 seconds, but everybody in the car should know that this is not going to have a good ending. This is not going to have a good ending. Now, that's where we are monetarily in the historical panoply of history. This is not going to have a good ending. In the first four programs here in this series now, we're talking about the privateer. And I reported to you here from the privateer, number 633. I said, hey, this has got some bad, bad omens coming up. Now, we're 6 inches off the ground, and we're headed toward the edge of the road, and we're going off the road without a doubt. There are oftentimes survivors that come out of these wrecks. We're headed for an economic wreck, and there's going to be survivors. There's going to be victims. No two ways about it. So at this juncture of time, there isn't anything we're going to do to prevent the wreck. We're not going to speed it up. We're not going to slow it down. We're not going to prevent it, and we're not going to cause it. It's already in the mill. And all we're going to do is go through the experience, and we hope we survive it. And if we do, let's learn from it so that this doesn't happen to us again. A fellow by the name of Jeff Nelson wrote a three-part story. It's called The History of Silver, Part 1, Part 2, and Part 3. Came in over the web the other day. I don't have any further information other than the guy's name is Jeff Nelson. This was written on June 10th, 2009, about silver. It might have come off of Kitco. It doesn't have a sign here on the paper, so I can't tell you exactly where it came from, but I think the guy hit the nail right on the head. And it's something for all of us to learn from, even at this late stage. Even while our car is 6 inches off the ground, halfway around the 35-mile-an-hour curve, traveling at 110 miles an hour. This story has something for all of us. Listen to this. This is the start of a three-part series. Part one discusses the dawn of silver mining and the recognition of silver as a precious metal and money. Part two looks at the gradual buildup of global silver stockpiles over a period of centuries, while Part 3 looks at the rapid depletion of those stockpiles. Now, somewhere around 5,000 years ago, humanity began to master the process of extracting precious metals from ore. And according to the Silver Institute, the first sophisticated processing of silver occurred with an ancient tribe known as the Chaldeans, approximately 2500 BC. There were several properties of gold and silver which attracted our primitive ancestors. First, there was the aesthetic beauty of these metals. Secondly, these two metals were particularly malleable, making them ideally suited for a wide range of artistic and ornamental use. I'm going to pause right here and make a comment. The author here says that this occurred, according to the Silver Institute, about 2500 BC. That is very shortly after Noah's flood. So if you want to write this down, I'll give you the dates. Noah's flood occurred in 1656. That's 1656 years after Adam. In order for you to correlate that with AD and BC, it occurred in 2369 BC. So the number 2500 is a little bit too much. It more than likely occurred about 2000 to 1800 BC, when the Chaldean Empire was cooking very well and Abraham was alive. Abraham was born in 2006 and died around 18 something or other. He was 175 years old, so somewhere around 1825 or so, 1820 BC. Now that'll give you a little framework to hang these dates on so that in your mind, looking at it from the perspective of the Bible. Now, if you're practicing evolution, you know, help put a billion years on there, so whatever makes you feel good. But in real time, we're talking about 2000 to 1800 BC. Now, finally, these two metals. We're talking about gold and silver. Now, these two metals were scarce. Gold and silver are scarce. They're also known as precious. But they're not so scarce that it was impossible to amass large quantities of these metals. These considerations soon led to gold and silver becoming the first universally accepted money to have been devised by our species, and today they stand out as being the best forms of money ever devised by humanity. So I'll pause here for a moment and point out to you that humanity did not discover gold and silver coin, or gold and silver for the uses of money. It was God the Creator who discovered it first, created it, a bimetallic monetary system, and he put 17 times more silver into the earth's crust than gold when he created it, and he didn't get it incorrect. He put that 16-to-1, round numbers, 16-to-1 ratio, into the earth's crust for a reason. And he told us that he was going to give us the gold, the silver, the brass, and the iron in the earth for us to dig out. So the idea of using gold and silver as a monetary base did not evolve from our species. It involved our Creator. He's the guy that invented it. All right, now glittering gold was equated with being the metal of the sun, while shining silver was considered the metal of the moon. Thus, our primitive ancestors quickly established the first gold-silver price ratio. Each year, there were 13 cycles of the moon for each full cycle of the sun. Thus, the original price ratio between these two precious metals was established at 13-to-1. 13-to-1. Now, I'm going to underline the term, thus our primitive ancestors. All right, I want to bring up our primitive ancestors because I'm not so sure that our ancestors were as primitive as we give them credit for. For instance, it was at about this time in history that the Great Pyramid was built. It was built around 1600 BC. It was built by a fellow named Job. Job was the first book written in the scripture. Job was quite an engineer. As an engineer, he designed the Great Pyramid to sit on 14 acres. That's how big it is at the base, 14 acres. Now, 14 acres is a pretty good sized piece of real estate. It's bigger than your lot where your house is sitting on. It's bigger than the whole block that your house is sitting on. And indeed, an acre is about one block. It's about 14 blocks square. I mean, that's a pretty good piece of real estate there. It's around 4 blocks by 4 blocks. You know, that's a big piece of real estate. And it's level. That's quite an accomplishment of and by itself, but it's better than that. The Great Pyramid is made up of 2,300,000 square stones, and the 2,300,000 square blocks that are stacked up there are stacked up on heat expansion joints. So when the guy built it, he knew and understood the expansion qualities of the sun shining upon the rocks, and that they would expand and contract, and that they would crack and break without expansion joints. And on that 14 acres, built about this very same time that the Chaldean Empire was discovering gold and silver to be used, you know, in our primitive ancestors' monetary systems, it was built to square to plus or minus 1/2 inch on all four corners. And it wasn't until the laser transit was invented in 1964 and used on the pyramid to determine how square it was that we were able to determine that it was plus or minus 1/2 inch. Up until 1964, we couldn't even measure that pyramid. Now, to say that these people in ancient times were primitive, and it wasn't until 1964 that we were even able to measure their work, tells me that these people were a lot smarter than we give them credit for. Now, there's one more. Over in Athens, there's a big building over there called the Parthenon. The Parthenon is not built square. It's built at angles. It's built based upon the configuration of a man. So the stones, when they fit together and you look at it with your eye, if it were built square, then it would have a different configuration. But it is built with the angles put into it so that when you look at it, it looks like it's square when in reality it is not. And in order for them to build that, they had to cut all of those blocks. 70,000 pieces of stone went into there, and every one of them is unique. There is not two stones in that building exactly the same. That's not primitive. And in fact, today, they're rebuilding the Parthenon, and they're having a hell of a tough time. And they've spent $100 million in 30 years trying to reconstruct it. And the original builders, you know, these people who are called primitive ancestors, built those 70,000 stones and put it together in 8 years, and we haven't been able to reconstruct it in 30 years, and it was just recently that we were able to figure out the system that they used to cut the stones that they build it with, and that's been done in the last 30 years. Boys and girls, that's not primitive. There ain't anything primitive about these people in the past. They had a superior technology that we have not matched yet. If anybody is primitive, it's the world today compared to the ancient world. We're catching up, though. We're catching up. Now, glittering gold was equated with being the metal of the sun, and silver the metal of the moon. And science has subsequently determined that silver is approximately 17 times as plentiful in the Earth's crust Therefore, our early ancestors either stumbled upon this ratio that just happened to coincide very closely with the natural abundance of these metals, or they had a much more sophisticated understanding of geology than we give them credit for. Because for roughly 4,000 years, the average gold-silver ratio was 15 to 1. These ratios are especially interesting today, given that the price ratio is currently extremely skewed in gold's favor at more than 60 to 1. Now, as I speak, I checked the ratio yesterday and it was 70 to 1. So, when we price gold and silver today, we say that silver is $12.50 and gold is $938. So you just plug in $938 into your calculator and divide that by $12.50, and you get a ratio of 75.04 to 1, way, way out of balance with 16 to 1. Way, way out of balance. And if the balance was correct today, and gold was $938 yesterday, we'll just plug in 938, let's divide that by 16, the price of silver today should be $58.62, but it's not. It's about $12.50, $13. Now that's very important. You know, it's very important. For you and I, the Joe Sixpacks and the Sally Housewives, if we want to even up the playing field with J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, and Bank of America, you want to even up the playing ground here. There's an opportunity afoot here, and I'm going to tell you what it is, called arbitrage, where you can make back those losses that are being inflicted upon you by the inflation that's now running 13% per annum. And over the next 18 months is going to be 50, 100, or 200% per annum. Maybe per week or per month. I don't know when that's coming, but hyperinflation's in the cards. So wake up and let's smell the coffee here, and let's see if we can level the playing field a little bit. You know, for the average Joe Sixpack here. We don't need to level the playing field for Henry Kissinger, George Bush, are Timothy Gaither. Those boys are being taken care of quite handsomely. They're all insiders. They're all scoring big. They're all making money hand over fist. Don't worry about George Bush. He's going to be all right. Don't worry about Bank of America, Citicorp, and Goldman Sachs. They're okay. They're going to make it. And what you need to be concerned about is Joe Sixpack. How's Joe going to fare out in this economic meltdown? Now, for roughly 2,000 years, the center of silver production was the cradle of civilization, the various ascending and descending cultures which were located around the perimeter of the Mediterranean Sea. A thriving silver trade among these tribes developed, which reached its zenith sometime after the 8th century BC. Most of this early silver production came from the Larium mines located near the ancient capital of Athens, Greece. Annual silver production in this era was estimated at about 1 million ounces of silver per year, beginning in about the 8th century BC, a period of time about 100 years after Solomon. Now, as the mines of Larium were gradually depleted, ancient production shifted its focus to newly discovered silver deposits in Spain, and for the next 1,000 years, or until roughly 800 AD, Spain became the leading source of silver production around the world. Now, when production of the earlier mines steadily declined, the production from Spain did little more than offset this lower production from the Larium mines and the handful of other early sources of silver production. Thus, total production leveled off at a plateau of about 1.5 million ounces per year, beginning about the 5th century B.C., lasting until about the 8th century A.D. Now, while silver was never equated with gold in value due to its greater abundance, throughout the first 2,500 years of silver production, silver's status as money never diminished. And this is yet another piece of data to file away. Given that the majority of market commentators today, especially in North America, disparagingly refer to silver as simply an industrial metal. Now, the logic of these neo-experts is that because silver also has superior chemical and metallurgical properties in countless applications, in addition to its aesthetic beauty, that this somehow makes silver less precious. This kind of infantile reasoning would never have fooled our ancestors who lived 1,000 years ago, or 2,000 years ago, or 3,000 years ago, or even 4,000 years ago. In fact, with most of the global stockpiles accumulated over a period of 4,000 years now consumed, I mean literally consumed, in various industrial applications over the past 150 to 200 years, silver has literally never been more precious than it is today. Now, I should point out that of all of the gold that has ever been mined from the days of Adam and Eve until last night at 5 o'clock, virtually all of that gold is in somebody's hands today. Somebody in the world has physical possession of it. You may not know who, but somebody's got it. It hasn't been consumed and used up like occurs with steel. When you mine it out of the ground and you turn it into steel, and then you create an automobile, and then you take the automobile and use it for a while, and then you abandon the automobile and it rusts and goes back into the earth. I have an old car down here in the woods that somebody abandoned. It's one of those old 1900s, early 1900s with the spoked wheels. It might be as early as 1920. And it was abandoned down there at some time, probably during the Great Depression, you know, after it had worn out. And slowly it has just rusted away, just sitting down in the woods, gone off by itself, just rusting away. As I saw it the last time, 3 or 4 years ago, it's about, I'd say about half to two-thirds rusted away, just gone. Big hunks and flakes of rust are piled up on it, and you can just go down there with your pocket knife and scoop it off. You know, big pieces about the size of 50-cent pieces will just flake off and drop on the ground. So that steel that was mined out of the ground, probably up in the Mesabi Range someplace, you know, back around 1915 or 20, and turned into steel at the United States steel mill someplace in Pennsylvania, and then sold to some manufacturing company, turned it into an automobile, and now it's rusting away. See, that steel has been used up. It's been consumed. Gold has not. It's been saved. All of the gold has been saved. It may be in somebody's ring. It may be in somebody's necklace or crown jewels, or it may be in a brick or a bar or a coin, but somebody still got it. It hasn't dissipated. It hasn't been consumed and used up, and then it has dissipated back into the ground like silver has. You see, silver is used as a monetary metal. That metal is still around. And half of all of the silver that we know about today, about 600 million ounces. Now, tuck this one away, write it down so you can tell your wife or your husband tonight at dinner. Of all of the gold in the world, there's about 2 billion ounces. B, that's with a boy. 2 billion ounces, and we've got all of it. All of the silver that's available today for sale is about 600 million ounces, less than a billion. Little over half a billion, but less than a billion ounces of silver. And half of that is owned by the Indians. So 300 million ounces is sitting in India. About a billion people have half the silver in the world. So now you know where it's at. Out of 209 countries in the world, one country, India, a big one, a billion people, about one-sixth or one-seventh of the world's population, they've got half of all the silver in the world. And the other 209 countries in the world, including you and me and everybody else, gets to split up and share the other half, about 300 million ounces. Way less than the 2 billion ounces of gold that's available out there in somebody's hands, somebody's possession. All right, we're at the halfway point here. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, and that we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on Compact Desk, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of that can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package, so be sure to order yours by calling the law school and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about arbitrage here. The history of silver, part one. All right, let's take a look at the history of silver, part two. Remember, this is written by Jeff Nelson, June 15th, 2009. It could be that it's put out by the Silver Institute. It could have been that that was the source of it. I'm going to file these two papers in my silver file. Or I might put them under arbitrage. If you look back in our archives, you'll see that we've talked about silver here and arbitrage before. There's a number of programs that I've done on the subject. But Jeff Nelson did a good job here on the history of silver, and I thought we'd stick that in here as a sequel to the welfare state's collapse, because that's what's coming. In spite of all of the hope for the future and all of the bright and hopeful signs of the stimulus working to save our economy, the ultimate end of this is going to be a no good end. Part two. Now, in part one of this series, I provided a brief exposition of the birth of silver mining and explained how and why silver came to be universally considered a precious metal and to be considered money by virtually all of humanity worldwide in our past history. Here in part two, I'm going to provide an outline of the development of silver mining and the huge growth of global silver stockpiles, which have accompanied such production and growth, and which ended in the last century with modern technology, when modern technology came up with an endless list of new applications for silver in a whole host and plethora of inventions. Now, as humanity entered the Middle Ages, the production of silver had been hampered by two constraints: the lack of new deposits or mines to offset the depleted reserves of the older First World mines, and the primitive technology of that era, which made only rich near-surface deposits feasible to mine. Now, concurrently, two changes occurred which allowed a dramatic increase in the amount of silver produced in the world. First, in the 15th century, the Americas were discovered, and a very large historical slight to the indigenous peoples of these continents, along with the Nordic explorers who had reached North America centuries earlier. Nevertheless, it was the highly publicized expeditions of the 15th century explorers and those who came after them which allowed the economic development of the Americas, for example, the exploitation of their vast wealth of natural resources in the 15th, 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. Among the most highly prized resources of the New World were precious metals, gold and silver. Meanwhile, with science emerging from the Dark Ages, improvements in mining technology allowed a vast expansion in the production of silver and other metals. Bolivia was the first New World target country for silver mining. And according to data from the Silver Institute, between 1500 and 1800 AD, somewhere around 1 billion ounces of silver were extracted from Bolivia in that 300-year period. However, while Bolivia was the initial destination in the Americas for silver mining, Mexico soon became the largest silver producer. And over that same time frame, there was an estimated 1.5 billion ounces of silver produced in Mexico, with the majority of that production occurring in a single century, that is, from 1700 to 1800. Now, the third principal producer in the New World was Peru. Silver mining in Peru did not commence until significantly later than in Bolivia and Mexico. However, by 1600, it is estimated that the annual production in Peru had reached roughly 3 million ounces per year, with more than half a billion ounces extracted by 1800. So, to provide some perspective as to how important these new centers of silver production were, from a global perspective, between 1500 and 1800, these three New World producers accounted for roughly 85% of the total global silver trade, despite the fact that in 1500, silver production was just beginning there. There were such vast quantities of silver that had been mined and stolen from the native inhabitants and shipped back to the New World, or the Old World, rather. And then the production of silver in Bolivia, Peru, and Mexico between 1500 and 1800, which added new millions upon millions of ounces, It actually made silver very cheap nor inexpensive compared to gold. Now, to show you how valuable silver and gold are, there's a ratio called the arbitrage ratio between silver and gold. Now, as designed by the creator of the universe, we're talking about God now, the creator, he put 17 ounces of silver into the earth's crust for every ounce of gold that he put in there. So the correct, the natural ratio is 17 to 1. Now, before the discovery of the new world's greater, vaster silver deposits, prior to 1500, the ratio of the gold-silver ratio was kept at around 13 to 1. 13 ounces of gold equaled, 13 ounces of silver equaled 1 ounce of gold. 13 to 1. There was a time in the 2nd century A.D., when gold and silver in the marketplace for a short period of time reached its zenith in price, when the arbitrage ratio between gold and silver reached 2 to 1. That is, silver was valued at half the price of gold. Now, in 1344, the price of silver in the Old World, now remember, this is before Columbus set sail, the price of silver for a short period of time in 1344 reached the price of $850 an ounce, based upon 1997 dollars, 1997 U.S. dollars. That's a pretty significant price, $850 an ounce. Now, those are extremes, and I cite those two extremes because that's not the natural or the normal price for silver and gold. It's not the design price. It's not the created price. But it demonstrates that from time to time, when the marketplace, because of war or population or because of the need, whatever it may be, there will be times when there are great fluctuations in the price of gold and silver. But its natural price, always remember this, the natural price is 17 to 1. Now, over the past 200 years, for the sake of simplicity, it has been priced at 16 to 1 because 16 divides into 100 easier. You know, 16 will divide into 100, 16 and a half divides into 100. Now, 16 to 1 has been the traditional price over the past 200 years, just a tad less than the natural price. So the artificial 16 to 1 price tag, since the discovery of the New World and the silver stores put into circulation, and then in 1873, the United States demonetized silver and went on to gold standard until 1933. Now, there have been price fluctuations in the 20th century, and I'll identify those for you. In 1919, the silver-gold arbitrage price dropped to 16 to 1. In 1942, it dropped to 16 to 1. And in 1980, it dropped to 16 to 1. And on the other end of the scale, the gold-silver arbitrage price range has been as high as 101 to 1. And as I mentioned earlier, today it's at about 70 to 1. So right now it is artificially high for gold and low for silver, when the normal price is 16 to 1 and the artificial price is 70 to 1, there's an opportunity here to make a lot of money. There's a great opportunity here. If we thought that the price of gold and silver was, for whatever reason, going to, at some point in time, go back to 16 to 1, and we cashed our gold in for silver and sat on the silver until it moved back to 16 to 1 from 70 to 1, the profit margin would be 400%, 4 to 1. 4 to 1. 3.75 to 1 at 60 to 1. And this is called arbitrage, and it's based upon the price, that is the dollar price that we artificially place on gold and silver out here in the marketplace. We'll cover that a little bit more later. Now, by 1800, silver production was moving north into the United States, and large deposits were discovered in the United States. And one very notable deposit was called the Comstock Lode in Nevada. Now, with these new mining capitals in the United States providing vast quantities of ore for miners, and with the steady improvement in mining methods and technologies, global production of silver continued to rise, so that by the latter half of the 1800s, annual production fell somewhere between 40 to 80 million ounces per year. Now, naturally, gold mining and global production of gold followed a similar trajectory to that of silver. But that's a whole new story of and by itself. With large stockpiles of gold and silver being accumulated in the form of jewelry and other ornamental applications in the hands of private entities, and then concurrently the large inventories of bullion held by governments and banks and other institutions, which formed the basis of our global monetary system in an era when people actually possessed real money in their physical possession. Now, throughout this era, the amount of mined and refined metal continued to increase faster than the population of the world. And this continued on into the early part of the 20th century. And then things changed. In our own modern era, rapidly evolving technology and mass production of an enormous array of goods altered silver's value in our society from being only a precious metal used for money and jewelry to becoming an ever more important industrial metal to be used in the fabrication and use of electronics materials. Now, noted silver researcher and commentator Ted Butler provides us with some information as to how these huge global stockpiles were at their peak in a good time to buy silver. In 1959, there were about 9 billion, spelled with a B as in boy, 9 billion ounces of silver bullion, equivalent in the world population of about 3 billion people. That was a per capita amount of 3 ounces of silver for each of the world citizens as recently as 1959. However, in just 50 years since 1959, these numbers have changed dramatically. The paradigm shift where silver production produced global stockpiles of silver which continually rose faster than our global population ended permanently. This was a market trend which had been intact for more than 2,000 years. Boys and girls, for the last 2,000 years, the amount of silver being produced in the world has always exceeded the number of people being born, so that by 1959, the per capita amount of silver in the world, mined and in physical possession, was 9 billion ounces for 3 billion people, or 3 ounces per capita. What is it in 2009? How many ounces of silver are there per capita? To find how dramatically this trend has been altered and reversed, you will have to read Part 3, unless you want to do your own research. In the conclusion of this series, you will see why silver bulls are so rabidly enthusiastic about the future, for those who are buying silver bullion products, that is, real bullion, not paper promises, and accumulating positions in quality silver mines now. Gold may seem to shine brighter for most people looking at precious metals investments today. However, the metal of the moon is poised to eclipse the metal of the sun in the not-too-distant future, and most likely the very near future. And when that day arrives, silver will completely shed its label as poor man's gold. Poor man's gold is what silver is called. All right. The History of Silver, Part 3. The inventories are gone. Well, let me give you a couple of three numbers for you to write down for your husband when he comes home tonight for dinner, so that you can bedazzle him with your brilliance, ladies. Remember that one half of all of the silver that's available for sale in the world resides in India. The other one half resides in the rest of the world. So the Indians are in possession of one half of all of the available metal of the moon that is available. Now, do you have this down? 2 billion ounces. That's 2 with 3 zeros, and then 3 more zeros, and then 3 more. That's 9 zeros. 2 with 9 zeros, billion ounces of gold, is in somebody's possession right now around the world. We don't know who, but it's available for sale. Now, there's only 300 million ounces of silver in the world for sale. It is true that in India, there probably is some silver for sale, but primarily the people of India buy silver and keep it. They hold it. They hang on to it. And they do that because it's a precious metal, and that's the way they store their wealth. The people of India, per se, don't believe in paper money. While it's true, the government of India prints paper money and the billion people in India use paper money, the people of India do not save. They do not put their savings in paper money and put it under their mattress. They buy silver, which is called poor man's gold, and then they store that silver, typically in the form of ornamentation, jewelry that women wear. That's the way they hold their wealth. Americans like to hold their wealth in paper, in stocks and bonds, negotiable instruments, mortgages, and other such commercial paper. Now, the commercial paper is losing value every day. Your mortgage now, probably, if you're like many people, today the mortgage that you hold, you owe more than the house is worth. You have a negative equity. You don't have any savings. You don't have any equity. You owe more than the property is worth. That's the legacy of irredeemable fiat paper currency. The people of India know that. They don't want to be left holding the old maid. They hold silver. Now, there's 300 million ounces of silver for sale in the world. We don't know exactly who it is that has all that silver, but in theory, there's 300 million ounces for sale. But there's 2 billion ounces of gold. My God, that's 6 times more gold than there is silver. And silver should be 17 times more plentiful than gold, but it isn't. All right, we'll take a look at what that means next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Let me remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.